One of the things that I get to do as being the person that organizes this is I get to choose the speaker that we hear. And I was very selfish this year. I wanted to have a guy to tell his story because we've had several women in a row that have told their story. And so I started thinking. And Terrell is someone that I have seen around for as long as I've been in the program because my sponsor believed in service work early, and so she dragged me to assemblies every time they were there, which I didn't think at the time was a good thing, but it really was a good thing. And so I have seen Terrell and Charlene. I have seen them at the International and all around, but I don't know anything at all about their story. And so I wanted to hear what their story was. So I'm going to turn it over to Terrell.
Thank you, Jared. I don't know about their story. I might give you mine. But anyway, thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. This really goes a long way in the growth of my recovery. It really, really does. It's funny, when Clara got up here and she had all her stuff, and a little earlier I had talked to Marcia and she confirmed something for me that I had thought about days ago. Was one time her late husband AD, I heard speak, and you know, he got his little cards and he, is this any better?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Got his little cards and he talked about, he says, I have these notes and so forth, and he says, I really need to have those primarily because if I'm going along and I have a moment and lose my place or all of a sudden I don't realize where I am, he says, I need to look at the note to see. He says, if I don't, he says, I have to start all over again. So, and I don't want to do that to you, so I made some notes. But anyway, I guess we go to the beginning, but the beginning is really, I guess for lack of a better term, a little bit vanilla, because in my early childhood, I was born in a little old town, Clocheville, Louisiana. I don't know if you know where that is, but it's in the general vicinity of Marksville in that area. Now, I came to New Orleans when I was about 6 months old. I made many trips back to stay with my grandparents during summers. In fact, I lived with my maternal grandparents for about a year. My mom was in a hospital. But, you know, I have no recollection of the effects of alcoholism at all. Now, I say that, you know, my maternal grandfather, the one I stayed with, was supposedly loved a little bit of alcohol, needless to say. I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not. He never claimed to be. But at least to the best of my knowledge, I don't recall any effects of that from him. Now, I had some uncles, my mother's brothers, who were, without any question, one was an alcoholic because he was very early in AA. Guys used to come pick him up and drag him to meetings. So I guess he was a declared alcoholic, if you will. Had a couple of other uncles who didn't declare themselves, but in my own opinion, I think they were. But nevertheless, I just didn't have the effects around me immediately. No, they lived away. I guess I really like to pick up from 11 years old, and not because of alcohol, but at 11 years old, and this is just, I feel I'll relate this because for two reasons. One is because it was a significant emotional event in my life, plus the fact Al-Anon eventually, now remember this is about 11, and I came into Al-Anon, I forgot, 95, beginning of 96. And it took some time after that for me to eventually work through this process. And what happened was, we lived in Gentilly at the time, near the Lakefront Airport. And a very good friend of mine, in fact, my best friend at the time, we used to get in trouble a lot and all that sort of good stuff. And behind our houses, there was nothing but woods, canals, and so forth. And we used to go hunting back there sometimes. And we'd go hunting with a single-shot 22 rifle. And one day, I mean, we hadn't been back in the woods for I couldn't tell you how long. And this rifle sat in his little utility room outside. So we decided, along with another friend, we were going to play firing squad. You can kind of see where this is going, but nevertheless. But it had a couple little twists to it, because when we started playing firing squad, the first person up against the house was me. And my friend Wayne had the rifle, and the other friend had a broomstick or whatever he had. And so we went through the motions of the firing squad. Wayne cocked the rifle and pulled the trigger, and, you know, just like it was supposed to be, nothing happened. So it became his turn against the house. And unfortunately, when I did the same thing he did, the rifle went off. And now you got to understand, Wayne was, I mean, he was just a kidder and tried all kind of little stunts, you know. And so he started hollering, he was shouting, he was running all the way inside the house and back. And the whole time he's doing that, I'm thinking he's playing games with me. Well, he wasn't playing games with me, because he died. And the first time I related that, now Charlene knew about this, my kids knew about this, but that's probably all. My parents had passed away, obviously they knew about it. But when that happened, I probably, in looking back, had probably the greatest example of compassion provided to me that I think of, you know, that I can really remember. And strangely enough, that compassion came from Wayne's mom. And she did everything in the world she could to make our family feel better, make me feel better. I would just venture to say, from the day after that happened, or just to say the day after the funeral, not a word was ever spoken about that. Not one. We didn't talk about it at home. Nobody else talked about it. Eventually, we moved from Gentilly and basically lost touch with his parents. And so from that time on, basically the people who knew about that after my parents passed away was Charlene and my kids. They knew about it. So I'm going to come back to that a little later, because it really gets woven into this wonderful program. This wonderful Al-Anon program. My later years after that, we moved around a lot, but it wasn't, you know, moving from anything. It was trying to move to something. My parents were always trying to improve our, quote, lot in life, if you will. We lived in different neighborhoods and places in New Orleans, in Metairie. We lived in Thibodaux for a couple of years, and I had the distinction of having gone to 3 high schools in 4 years and not being a discipline problem. It's really interesting how all that worked out, but nevertheless, and still, I can't give you any alcohol, drug, or any of those kinds of stories of addiction. My senior year of high school, I was out at the lakefront with some friends of mine, and there were some young ladies out there whom I knew, most of them. And that's when I saw Charlene. I decided that they should introduce me to her. And they did. And not being one to really want to kind of let the grass grow under your feet, so to speak, I invited her to my senior prom that day. And of course, being the coy little thing that she is, I didn't say was, I said is. She says, well, I can't go out with you till you meet my parents. So I said, okay. So I guess the mistake was that she told me where she lived. So the next weekend, in the rain, I appeared at the front door. And said, here I am, and I'm to fulfill this obligation, you know. Well, long story short, we did go to my senior prom. And from that time all the way through college, we dated off and on. Now, if you hear Charlene's story, she will tell you that I chased her and chased her and chased her. Now, I'm not going to deny that. But as Paul Harvey would say, I'm going to give you the rest of the story. I did chase her and chase her, but she made it so easy to get caught. You know? So, but anyway, we, you know, I graduated from Southwestern in Lafayette, and we started on a trek of about 4 years in the Air Force. And first child, first son was born at West Point Academy in New York. I wasn't there for that because I drove her to the hospital, and the rules of the game at that military hospital at the time was, fine, goodbye, we'll call you when the baby's born. A long way from what it is now, you know. But anyway, so that's how that went up. The middle child, I was in Goose Bay, Labrador. I saw him when I came home on leave for Christmas when he was 6 weeks old. So the third child, and the last one, she was determined that I was going to be there, okay? And, you know, I was. But after two boys, and looking back at family history and so forth, there was no question the third one was going to be a little boy. I mean, and I had myself programmed for 9 months that that's what was going to happen. Until I was in Baptist Hospital in a waiting room, and a nurse comes out wheeling this little incubator, and she says, would you like to see your daughter? Well, you know when you start saying something and you realize it's really not what you want to say, but it just keeps coming out? You know? I asked her, how do you know? How can you tell? And she assured me that she could tell. She did. So with that, Christine was born, and we have these three lovely children, and you know, and kind of life went on until the middle child was around 20 years old. We got a visit from some good friends of ours. I think he was either at LSU or had recently been to LSU, but anyway. A good friend of his, this was the parents of a good friend of his, came to see us and proceeded to tell us about they thought that Paul was involved in drugs and alcohol. And I'm here to tell you, whether I should have or shouldn't have or whatever all, this was like news to me. I had no idea about anything that was going on. And I don't know if this was denial or there were any legitimate reasons why I didn't know, but this was just an absolute total shock. So anyway, we ended up getting hooked up with to go see a counselor at what used to be Joe Ellen Smith Hospital in the West Bank. And I guess what Paul proceeded to do, the lady spoke to us separately, she spoke to Paul separately, she spoke to us all together. And her final words before we left was, you know, in talking with Paul, yeah, he admitted that he had done some stuff, but that kind of stuff, that life was kind of behind him. Well, I'm here to tell you that he probably conned her as much as he conned us, because Lord only knows it was not behind him. You know, it was just a real roller coaster ride after that. You know, I don't want to get involved in a lot of his story, but you know, where I was coming from, where we were coming from, was, you know, we were out of town. We had drug dealers in the house taking TVs and VCRs and jewelry to pay for whatever drugs he was getting. The alcohol he managed to buy himself, I guess, because it was cheaper. But you know, that stuff just went on and on, and we went and see a counselor, and she was a wonderful lady. She really, really was. She is. She's still around doing that, I believe. What she would ask us after a while. She, you know, we got educated about the disease of, you know, of addiction and alcoholism and so forth, and you know, but she asked us if we had ever been to an Al-Anon meeting. And no, never been to one. And every time we'd go back, we had the same question. Not a lot of reaction to it. She just says, have you been to an Al-Anon meeting? I said, no, we haven't been to an Al-Anon meeting. That was the end of that part of the conversation, and we'd go on with the session. So finally, after a number of times, Charlene and I are looking at each other, and I said, man, look, I can't go back and tell that lady I haven't been to an Al-Anon meeting. I said, look, let's just go to a meeting. We'll go to the meeting. We'll come back and say, yes, we have, and that'll be the end of that. Well, we did, and it really was not the end of that. You know, here I am today. But it was kind of an interesting process because it really started out, you know, they talk about staying long enough to witness the miracle. You know, that was an immediate miracle with me. I mean, when I tell you immediate, you know, I didn't want to go to Al-Anon. You know, it was a typical feeling, typical where I was coming from was, I don't have a problem. You know, I don't have to get off of alcohol. I don't have to get off of drugs. He does. I've been trying to help him do that and tell him how he could possibly do it. And nothing has worked. But I don't know why I have to go. But the interesting part about it is I did go and I kept going back. And if you got inside of me, you know that that was a miracle. Because normally that probably would have never happened. So there had to be something working besides just me and my keep going back, you know. And I kind of like the idea of being told that I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. That really, you know, that really kind of made things a little bit better because as a parent, I figured I had a responsibility to help that kid get well. It wasn't that I ought to do that, you know, because that's a nice thing to do, but to try to help him. This was, you know, you're nurturing a little thing like this as they grow up and you put Band-Aids on Bobos, and he was a Bobo I couldn't put a Band-Aid on. But I thought that I should be able to put a Band-Aid on it. And so I'm kind of forcing this issue of, you know, I'll go to Al-Anon, maybe they can tell me how I can help get this kid well. And as you probably know, nobody told me how to do that. They kept telling me about me getting well. And, you know, Paul went through some treatment centers and inpatient treatment centers that worked for a little while for him. And of course, when he first went, it was really kind of nice because knew where he was in a safe place, and he was doing well. But I was still attached to all that because if you wanted to know how Paul was doing, you did not have to know him, see him, or talk to him. You didn't have to talk to me either. You could just come to me and see how I was doing, and you would know exactly how he was doing. Because if he was doing well, I was doing great. If he was not doing too well, well, then neither was I. And that kind of was a little bit of a twist in going through that first step. You know, I had a lot of trouble, and I didn't even know I was having trouble with that first step. Because, you know, I intellectually knew I was powerless. God only knows I had tried all sorts of things. None of them worked. So intellectually, I knew I was powerless. But the problem was I didn't want to be. You know, I still had this parent thing working, and I hadn't felt it in here. I knew it up here, but I hadn't felt it in here about being powerless. And I think there's one of the sharings in Courage to Change, and it talks about Dr. Tebow, who was certainly a good friend of Bill W.'s, and he talked about the difference between submission and surrender. And he talks about submission, and, you know, my words, okay? His words are a little bit better than mine, but nevertheless, I can relate to mine better. It was kind of like letting him go, but still having this attachment to where I could pull him back in anytime I wanted. You know, I'm going to let you go, but there might come a time when I want you to pull you back in again. And surrender was obviously not that. It was just a total, absolute letting go, consciously and subconsciously, of just total surrender and letting go, which to me was extremely difficult. You know, my going through detachment with him was probably one of the most painful things I went through because, again, detachment I understood intellectually. I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be enabling him. I shouldn't be doing all these things. I need to let him go. In fact, after a meeting one evening, I had a lady, a friend of ours now, but she came to me and she just looked at me and she says, "When are you going to let him go?" And I kind of sat back and I said, "Gee, it must be something I need to do if I'm getting this kind of reaction." And later I told the same, you know, related that at a meeting, and she was at that meeting and she came to me afterwards. She says, "You know, I remember that and I have no idea why I did that." I said, "Well, I do, and I don't think you or I had anything to do with it, you know. I think the God of my understanding is kind of working through you," and that's how I got that message. And, you know, after meetings and discussions after meetings and sharing during meetings, God only knows I got all the help I needed. I just needed to do something with it. You know, after one time after a meeting, a friend of mine and I were talking, and at that meeting I had talked about, you know, one of the things I wanted to do. I could see how much pain this kid was in, and I needed to help remove that pain. And he says, "You know, the same pain you're trying to remove just might be the pain that might get him well." You know, it was another one of these proverbial 2x4s that hit you on the side of the head. I said, "My Lord, I need to think about that." And, you know, the whole enabling thing and doing things that we shouldn't be doing, I think really came to a head for me after all these things. I just got through telling you. You might think that, well, it should have come to a head by now, but it didn't. I mean, you know, I think Pat once said at the time of the meeting about being a slow learner and a fast forgetter. Well, that's what I was, okay? But one time that I recall specifically at a meeting was the idea that, you know, all those things that I was doing, we were doing for him, paying for this and paying for that and covering this and all that sort of good stuff that maybe you shouldn't be doing, you know, maybe what I was doing and what I needed to do was let him have the dignity to lead his life. And basically in doing what I was doing, I was taking his dignity away from him. In essence, what I was telling him was, "Okay, I'm doing all this stuff, and without me, you're not going to make it without me. I'm doing all these things for you, and if I don't do all these things for you, you're not going to make it." And, you know, in no other words, that was just one hell of a message that I just didn't want to send. And I, you know, that really kind of did it for me. And I, you know, I, like so many of us, have gone through this 1-2-3 waltz with those first three steps. But I'm back to that first step again and having some difficulty because I'm talking to someone again after a meeting and say, you know, when does this fear, when does this knot in my middle of my stomach at times go away? And she says, "Well, maybe you need to go back and look at the first step." And I'm thinking, "Oh, I don't believe this. Why don't I need to go back and look at it?" But, you know, I just, you know, and I did. And sure enough, it was back to this submission and surrender business. And I knew what I needed to do because, you know, I was fearing what I couldn't control, which is not an unusual aspect. I mean, you know, sometimes people don't like to fly because they can't fly the aircraft. If they could fly the aircraft, they probably wouldn't mind at all because they would be in control of the aircraft. But I think generally we tend to fear what we can't control. And that's what I was doing. So anyway, I would like to mention at this point that going through all of this was, at least for me, never easy, but it sure was easier that Charlene was also in this program. And that, for the most part, you know, some differences, but for the most part, we were on the same page about what we needed to do and how to go about doing it. You know, not always in sync, but in sync enough for it really to be an asset that both of us were in this program. And I really am forever grateful that that was the case. I think I failed to mention that I had a brother. You know, we had a small family. We didn't have this huge family. Mom had a number of miscarriages. But I had one brother who was 6.5 years younger than I. And we really, you know, I guess primarily because it was the 6.5 years, but we never did really have a close relationship. You know, his friends were different than the friends I had. You know, I was out of high school and going to college, and he was getting out of grammar school and that sort of thing. But, you know, a long story short, he died as a result of this disease. You know, he went through some outpatient treatment, and, you know, I think that he fell into this category, I believe, as is described in the big book, about he was one of these unfortunates who could just not get honest with himself. And, you know, he was just born that way. It wasn't his fault. And so anyway, that was another one of the things that was on my mind. That was my greatest fear with my son, was that I was going to get a phone call 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to come identify a body. It's probably the result of a couple of things. One is he used to always call at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, wanting to know if he could come home. You know, and the answer was, you know, yes, and he was in tears, and he was apologizing and everything else. So when that phone rang, it might have been him, might not have been him. But also, I made a huge mistake. You know, this need to know. You always had this need to know. Well, he was in treatment for the first time, and it was a family session. It was a family session for a week in Jackson, Mississippi. And it, you know, had to do a few things. He had to give a drug history and alcohol. Well, I'm here to tell you, Walgreens didn't have that many drugs in hand, okay? But he made a statement at one time when just Charlene, myself, and him together. And he says, look, if there's anything you want to know, just ask me and I'll tell you. And I'm thinking, boy, this kid's, you know, he's ready to just open up. And, you know, I didn't really have a lot I wanted to ask him. But there was one thing that was bugging me. I said, you remember when you borrowed the car one night? And the next morning I go outside in the driveway and a side view mirror is hanging this way. And about a day or two later I find out that the underneath and everything else was screwed up with the transmission. I said, you remember what you told me caused that? And he said, yeah. He only related when I asked him what happened to the side view mirror when it happened, because he says, I don't know. He says, I was just parked someplace and came out, and whoever was parked next to me must have knocked the mirror off. That didn't explain the transmission and all this other stuff. But he told me what it was. He says, what really happened was he had gone to buy drugs with no money. And, of course, one way you do that, if you're really brave, or I don't know about brave, maybe crazy and whatever all else we want to say, was he stole it through the window of the car. In other words, guy wanted to go hand him the drugs, and he just yanked them and took off. Well, it just so happened that the dealer had a car sitting right there who took off right after him and caught him. After the car had gone into a little ditch, by the way. That accounts for the transmission stuff. And all I can say is the God of his understanding had something in mind and has something in mind for him. Because that dealer got out that car, got to him, took the drugs back, and left. And I don't know how many times you think that might happen that way, but it ain't very many, okay? And I'm thinking, you know, it just reinforced to me the kind of environment he was in. And I'm waiting for this phone call, because I just know that one of these times I'm going to get this phone call. Well, you know, he went into treatment again after that. These were inpatient treatments for maybe 4 months at a pop. It came out the second time and went back out again. And I don't think coincidentally. Now, he's been, bless his heart, he's been clean and sober now for, I think, somewhere around 9 years. But the last time he was in treatment, he got called down at work. Well, we can think we got to give you a drug test. And he says, you don't have to give me one, I can tell you. And he checked himself into a 28-day program here in Baton Rouge. And whatever his insurance didn't cover, he floated a loan against his 401k and took care of the whole thing. And that's the one that worked, okay? I don't think it's coincidental that he did all that himself, okay? So, you know, and I don't believe in too many coincidences. I just happen to be one of those folks who thinks that it's, you know, more miracles where God chooses to remain anonymous than it is actual, quote, coincidences. You know, you guys are very, very patient with me. I needed to be patient with me because, like I said, about being a fast forgetter was really a problem. But anyway, going through these steps, especially that first step, really just made a huge difference in my life. The fourth step, I avoided the fourth step for a long time, but not for the same reason that a lot of people avoid the fourth step. I avoided the fourth step because I didn't want to have to tell all this to somebody in the fifth step. But somebody says, look, what you need to do is find yourself a really good Al-Anon friend who's moving out of town. And talk, and you can relate all that to them. Well, that's not what I did, but I thought about it for a while. Couldn't find anybody leaving to go out of town. You know, steps 5, 6, and stuff were truly steps that really taught me, among other things, a lot of humility. And humility is a word that gets bandied about a lot and probably has a bum rap. But if you can get into the largest dictionary in the world, you can probably find a Greek, what am I thinking of? Comes from the Greek and it really means teachable spirit. And that means a lot to me. It means that I'm willing to learn. I can, you know, talk to the God of my understanding. And I really am willing to learn and ask for help. And, you know, like I said, I think humility in a certain sense gets a bum rap. But looking at it as being a teachable spirit really made a lot of difference. Steps 9, 10, and 11. Sometimes you hear folks talk about those as growth steps, maintenance steps. I think they both. It just depends on where you are and, you know, and the process of going through those. But I think they're both growth and maintenance steps. And step 12 talks about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Well, first when I read that, I'm saying, okay, after I go through all of this, I'm going to have a spiritual awakening. I don't know how it happens with anybody else, but I had these little spiritual awakenings all through the process of going through those steps. There wasn't one big burning bush or anything else, but there were a lot of little big things that happened that changed as I was going through this, through the steps, and as I just continued to grow in this program. And the part about practicing these principles in all our affairs, aside from, you know, outside the household, my other two kids kind of like that idea of practice these principles in all your affairs, meaning stay out of their business. And it's really interesting because I have a lot less trouble doing that with the young man who brought me into this program than I do with the other two. And I was talking to someone about that a couple of weeks ago. And they said, well, you know, it just might be that both of you talk the same language. And I think that that's true. You know, I think that he can understand where I'm coming from and realize things from his program that, you know, yeah, understand what you're saying, you know. Now, my daughter understands somewhat. She went through Al-Anon for a little while, just enough to become extremely dangerous. But between what she did pick up and I think what she has probably gotten through osmosis from us, because you can listen to a talk sometime and she's talking program, okay? There is no question about it. And I don't know if that's something she carried over from when she did go to Al-Anon for a while, or whether it's through osmosis with us or whatever all, but you know, she's got some program in it, some kind of way. And I talk about this because, you know, the family dynamics was just a whole different story. You know, she did go to Al-Anon and so forth. My other son, I'm not going to say never, because I don't know exactly where he is now, but he really could not, at least initially, grasp the concept that this was a disease, and his brother, you know, didn't necessarily want to do what he was doing, but, you know, in fact, I think that if sometimes he could get close to his brother when certain things were going on, he would probably be in jail right now after homicide. I mean, he just got that crazy. You know, he was trying to do things to help us, protect us, make us feel better, because he could see what was going on. And the whole family dynamics, you know, it truly is a family disease. It truly is a family disease. And just a couple of more things, and I'll end this. You know, I can't talk enough about recovery without talking about service. Service has been an extremely important part of my recovery. I don't know if I contributed a whole heck of a lot, but I'm talking about service in terms of moderating meetings, chairing meetings, being an IR, a GR. There's a lot of R's, so they get a lot of opportunities, you know, to be these things. But what it did was it did give me an opportunity to, in some small way, kind of give back to a program that has done so much for me. But what it also did was, in terms of my recovery, it put me more in touch with people in this program. You know, it wasn't just seeing these people at a meeting or at a workshop. I mean, this was, you know, depending on what it was, I was in touch much, much more frequently with people in this program. And as a result of that, it helped my program. So I really can't say enough about getting into service. It took me a while to do it, but I did it and I'm still doing it. But it really has been just an extremely important part of my recovery. I kind of have a philosophy that really life is all about relationships. If I think about it, it really is all about relationships. Maybe a relationship with my higher power, with myself, my spouse, my kids, if it's people at work, just people generally. It's just relationships everywhere. And that's what it's all about to me. You know, a good while back I was reading this book, and in the intro the author makes a couple of statements, and he says something I wish I would have said, but he says, "I suppose that since most of our hurts come through relations, so will our healing." So, you know, all these relationships, you know, some of them need to end. Maybe that's what the outcome is for some relationships. Others maybe need to be nurtured a little bit more, and whatever the situation, but it's just all about relationships to me. And as much as an adult as you try to get that in my head, you know, sometimes, we were talking the other day about Art Linkletter and kids say the darndest things. I don't know if you recall that or not, but not too long ago, I got an email that had a whole bunch of little kids who wrote letters to God. And you know, kids have a way of making, not intentionally, but making very profound statements through what they say. And this little girl, her name is Nan. And to do her justice, I want to read it to you. Very brief. It says, "I bet it is very hard for you to love all of everybody in the whole world. There are only 4 people in our family, and I can never do it." You know? So, you know, it really is all about relationships, even this high, you know? And with that, again, I would like to, you know, like I said, I could go on forever about this program and what it has done for me, but I won't. But what I'd like to leave you with is one favorite, I'm not going to say lady in my life because I've never met the lady, but it's Mother Teresa. And this thing is all raggedy now, and I read it frequently. But it really has been a lot to me because it kind of relates to, it really doesn't make any difference what other people think. You know, I'm not responsible for what they think. I might be doing something and they interpret it a certain way, and I get that kind of feedback, and you know, I don't really care anymore. But I'd like to read this to you because it really is important to me, and I'll leave you with these thoughts. It's a message from Mother Teresa. And she says, "People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you have anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. Thank you."